You're listening to Uncanny Landscapes, Excursions into the Otherwise, with Justin Hopper.
The life of a book and the life of a tree, even though the pages are made of dead tree, are really fundamentally kind of opposed to each other. And so thinking through in terms of the eco-poetic angle, you know, what it is about our drive to still knowledge and create books in that way that sets us apart from these life cycles, these non-human life cycles that are kind of moving and changing all of the time.
Welcome to Uncanny Landscapes, a series of conversations around and excursions into landscapes of the otherwise. Each episode features a conversation with a landscape practitioner, someone whose work is rooted in the strange ways we today experience our surroundings. And I'm your host, Justin Hopper. You've just heard today's guest, artist and poet Camilla Nelson, talking about the contradictions involved in publishing books about our bizarre relationship with the environment. More from Camilla very soon. The music you hear is the piece Slipstream of Memory by Chiron from a new album on the Bellbury Music label entitled Dreaming Eden. You can subscribe to Uncanny Landscapes on Substack. It's free and includes the podcast, as well as my newsletters of related topics and works in progress. And if you like this stuff, like and subscribe and tell a friend, or maybe a few. The poetry of a tree, of a mushroom, a bird song, a lizard's tail, is obvious to most. It is a poetry of breath and movement and song and deep, deep being. It is a poetry from which we humans can learn so much. Perhaps I should say, in some cases, relearn. It seems entirely possible that our poetry once was that of the mushroom and the songbird. But how would we go about writing like a mushroom today? Camilla Nelson doesn't necessarily have the answer, but she's making some beautiful work as she tries out different ways of asking the question. Nelson is an artist whose work explores the materiality of language, particularly in relation to the other than human. She's published books of the well-known sort, words printed on paper, for poetry publishers such as Contraband and Guillemot Press. Through her Singing Apple Press, she's published books of the less well-known sort, using objects, images, fragments, and concepts from the non-human world. And she's made installation art, curated exhibitions, and made the radio program Becoming, among many other things. Becoming has itself become an online workshop that she will lead for the second time this summer, and that I recommend checking out if you're interested in this kind of work. You can learn all about it by visiting singingapplepress.com, or just look in the podcast or Substack info. Plus, she'll discuss it in our conversation. In fact, here she is, talking about Becoming right now, Camilla Nelson.
With both of these workshops at the moment, I'm doing this six-month residency in my garden, which sounds a little bit mad, like I'm doing a kind of lockdown residency all over again. But it almost is, in that all of the Becoming work came out of that like lockdown period where we were, you know, hyper focused on you know, a very small local area to where we were by necessity. And in running these workshops, I decided, rather than it being something where you launch something and hopefully you get people to come along and you know, it is successful and you get paid and all of these good things and they go away with good experiences, I was like, I want to run something that is going to feed my own practice. So whether you have, you know, like two people or whether you have 40 people on a course, it's something you're doing anyway. And so it's a vehicle to share your practice, but also to encourage you to keep doing it, even as you are working with other people and hopefully like disseminating that. And so the Becoming, I'd already started that obviously last year in the course format. I've extended it a little bit this time because it felt a little bit too cramped, and even I was finding it difficult to make work in between each session. So I've given You know, it starts with becoming fungus. So we have a sort of initial Zoom. For every 2 week block, there's an initial Zoom class where I share the workshop prompts and materials, and then everyone gets a worksheet. And then you've got a week to make the work, and then you post it or share it on the kind of Google Drive, and then everybody reflects and feeds back for a week, whilst also probably listening to the next radio series, which would go into then becoming plant, becoming insect, becoming bird, becoming animal.
Just tell us a little bit about your practice and how it fits into a bigger idea of sort of environmental art and eco-poetics, and you've used the word in your website, at least, performance writing, and tell us a little bit about those kinds of practices.
Yeah, sure. So I call myself a language artist because even though I've come from a background of page-based poetry, I'm really interested in thinking about language as material. So what language is physically made of, you know, whether it's ink on paper, whether you're making words out of stones on grass, whether you're, you know, just writing, say, for example, using a stick and writing into water. So there's no visible trace necessarily, but there's a gesture and there's an intention. So the creation of physical language is what I'm really interested in. But obviously that actually extends into breath and sound, because that comes out of the physical body. So for me, there's a kind of continuum. Often the spoken word and the written word are kind of seen as these slightly separate practices. But for me, it feels like they're part of the same thing, because language, whether it's breath, sound, spoken, gestural, for me is very linked in with the gestures that we make, you know, for example, with words on the page, or, you know, with the kind of materials of our environment as well. So there's that continuity for me. So I'm a language artist that works with language as material, and that, as you may have kind of imagined from my description, moves from page-based work to performance. And that can be sound performance. It can be embodied. I've worked with dancers in the past. And it can also be installations, you know, things that are is installed either in the gallery space or outside in different spaces. So it goes across a lots of different environments and media.
And we're also talking about publishing in a way that isn't always necessarily as sort of mainstream as printing words onto a piece of paper. Can you tell me briefly, tell us a little bit about some of the kinds of publications that you've made? If publications is the right word.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, that's exactly what I struggle with, because sometimes I say book works, or, you know, it slightly kind of moves beyond the normal terminology we might have. But so I started Singing Apple Press coming out of my PhD, which was in performance writing. So performance writing being very much a materially engaged view or attention to language, as I've described. So working with kind of material and performance of language making. And in that PhD, I had been focusing, the title had been Reading and Writing with a Tree, Practicing Nature Writing as Inquiry. So rather than having a sort of set text like you might have, you know, Ulysses, that, you know, is your key text that you're working with, I was sort of bringing the reading writing practices to bear on a tree, which is obviously not a book. It's not a sort of like literary object as we would normally see. And that was a kind of like deliberate disjuncture, because I felt like if we apply those reading and writing practices to something that is not sort of intended to be read or written, you come up against the barriers of what is possible for reading and writing. And you come up against the boundary of like what it is to be a tree. So it was a kind of method of slightly strange disjunction in order to find out more about what a tree is and more about reading and writing. And so as a result of that, like all of these strange hybrid language works came into the world that had sort of, you know, twigs and branches, and or maybe that were actually installed into the tree. So writing.
So-
every apple on the tree. It was an apple tree that I was working with.
Oh, right. So you were literally talking about a single tree.
It was one single tree. It was one very physical single tree, in a particular in the orchard in the Tremeau campus in Falmouth University. And so there was the seasonal ramifications of that as well. And so, you know, with publishing, it's very linked into our idea of knowledge, knowledge creation and knowledge storing. The idea that we create this book, it will then be inside and kept quite carefully and be able to be referenced over time for hopefully quite a long amount of time. And that's a way of storing knowledge sort of outside of our bodies. And this seasonal work with the tree, and obviously, you know, the leaves fall, the apples fall, they degrade, and nothing, well, you know, other than the body of the tree, the apples and the leaves disappear or absorb back into the roots and kind of reappear for the following season. So that seasonality and that kind of ephemerality became part of my language making. And then you think, well, what? How do you publish in this sense? Like, what is a book in this sense? And what, again, it sort of calls into question what books do, how books emerge, and how books, how the life of a book and the life of a tree, even though the pages are made of dead tree, are really fundamentally kind of opposed to each other. And so thinking through in terms of the eco-poetic angle, you know, what it is about our drive to still knowledge. And create books in that way that sets us apart from these life cycles, these non-human life cycles that are kind of moving and changing all of the time. And so to answer your question about publication, how you create books in that spirit of trying to have the non-human agency or kind of plant life somehow present, somehow on its own terms, or at least kind of, you know, moving towards that, but in a book. It's this constant, like, difficult battle, but it felt like a worthwhile inquiry. And so I'd started up Singing Apple Press to do that. And so one of the book works I had made was quite early on was A Blackbird in Amongst the Crab Apples, which had a sort of more standard, like, hand-sewn book, black card bound, and then the crab apple jelly with a little dot of ink in it, so made from the crab apples. And the idea was that the drop of ink in the crab apple jelly was something somebody could consume that would bring them closer to the original tree, but actually, you know, it was a sort of hybrid metaphor for how we consume language.
In a time when we're trying to understand what the rest of the world is saying to us in various ways, in other words, you know, like you said, we're talking about pieces of paper that are made of dead trees. We're talking about ink. All of these things come from the environment in which we live, but the book is sort of like a dominating feature. You know, again, I'm just parroting this back to you. So is it the case that one part of what you're trying to do with this bigger practice is find is experiment with ways that might allow for the non-speaking, the non-verbal parts of the world to have some input into the way that we use language?
Definitely. Definitely. But I also recognize the naivety in that, you know, almost like the impossibility. But I feel like in keeping that impossibility, that sort of tension there, that I'm sort of trying to invite in these other, you know, other, like, particularly plants, ways of being into our ways of creating books that are totally antithetical to the way that plants are in the world. It's just highlighting how clumsy and clunky a lot of our human cultural practices are. I mean, let's not get too broad, but, like, you know, particularly when it comes to book creation and consumption, how clunky they are, but also how necessary. Like we wouldn't like the huge resources we have in terms of libraries and stored knowledge. Like I'm not saying, bookmaking needs to end, but it's just drawing attention to these everyday things that we are part of, complicit with all the time. And, just being aware that when you think about like creating a book of eco-poetry that may be very much focused on a love of trees or a love of plants or a love of the non-human, that even by producing that, we are complicit in the destruction of trees. And it's not saying that needs to end, but it's just trying to highlight the complexity of what we're involved with when we think and make in these ways.
And how does how do your performative pieces play into these same kinds of ideas or similar ideas? Where does a performance by Camilla Nelson fit onto the spectrum of these thoughts?
So I slightly, with the performative stuff, I end up going more into the body. And well, it really depends. I feel like I've got kind of three different performative strategies in mind when you say that. On the one hand, I think of the performance that I did very early on, it's kind of 10 years ago now, where I had written or marked into every single apple, one word into every single apple on this tree. And as the apples grew, obviously the branches shift with the weight of the apples. And so the words change their relationship to each other. So the idea of a linear writing where you start in the top left-hand corner in the Western world and move your way along these lines, and it's very carefully kind of composed as to what word comes after which, the life of the tree was just carrying on and changing this orientation between the words, and words would fall and start decomposing, or insects would start eating halfway into a word, or even creating their own lines through the words. And so that for me in itself felt like a performance. But then for me to engage with those words and to begin to try and read them, you become very aware of your own body in that, because there are certain words that are really difficult to reach and certain words you're having to get onto the floor and down.
Like quite literally, yeah.
Yeah, literally. And so for me, working with that tree was actually what brought me back into an awareness of my own body, because it was that sort of impossibility of not being. There can be a bit of a sort of like maybe not hatred, but certainly a sort of resentment perhaps of human being that creeps in with environmental concern, that feeling of kind of like the demonizing of the human, and like if we weren't here, everything else would be fine. And working with this tree, I was so concerned about trying to, minimize my influence. And yet, there were strands of my hair caught in the branches. There was like a bald track around the tree from where I'd been walking on the grass. There was no way other than me, even if I had, tragically, sadly died, I would still be there as a physical presence that would kind of rot down and be part of the world. So the impossibility of not being there, then like you're like, okay, well, I'm really here now. What is it about my body that is important and that this tree is kind of reminding me of? And so the performance of reading the tree to me brings you back into that real affirmation of we are bodies in this world and we are bodies in relationship. And yes, we will make poor choices or accidentally cause harm, but what are the positive choices we can make, and what are the positive things that we can move forward? But also, how we're always in that slightly sticky position of you might make two steps forward in a positive direction, and then you realize what you've done has sort of maybe created accidental pollution, or has had kind of negative ramifications.
And it plays into the language because language obviously doesn't stay the same. It's one of the things I always think about books, is that we can't pretend that a book written in 1895 means the same thing, and yet the you know, all of the sort of accoutrement of a book, of a library, of a sort of vast repository of knowledge tries to tell us that this is a thing that has stayed the same. And of course it doesn't really. So just like your apple tree, that sort of magnifies or amplifies the fact that language changes with the bowing of the branches and with the changes of your body. You know, my 7-year-old son couldn't read the same book off the apples as you, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, that's really interesting. So you said there were three sort of performative strategies in mind.
Yeah.
Is that, do you still, well, have you told us all three?
Yes, no. I mean, I think that's the first one. It was more kind of sort of performance, different types of performance. So the first was a kind of more obviously like ecologically engaged or kind of non-human interaction. The second, which kind of emerged out of that experience of relating to the tree that suddenly made me aware of my body, is much more about just the body in itself. And so thinking about how, sort of inspired actually by the falling apart of language that happened through the relationship with plant materials, or if you put any kind of like book related things outside, you know, lots of people have experimented with burying books or just leaving that side and seeing how they get eaten by insects or just gradually degrade with the weather. Being aware of that falling apart of language and how something becomes more visible as the language falls apart. It's actually the material conditions and the material of the language, the relationship between the stuff of the bookness with its environmental relations, with its environmental context, becomes really apparent. Like the forces that get in the way of legibility. And that became really interesting to me, thinking about how you would then enact a degraded text. Like how do you read in the sense of how would you perform a degraded text? How do you perform the fragments of word that are no longer word? And so I began to be really interested in the sonic equivalent, the vocal equivalent. So, you know, starting with I'm doing it now. We all do it a lot of the time. You have these pauses or glitches in the word where a word might begin to fall apart, whether that's through pausing or going slower or just stumbling, forgetting. But, you know, if I was to do a little demo, it would be something like, thinking about how sat with sound, if I started off with a sound, if I started off with a mush, no, oh, low. I mean, I didn't get to a word there, but in a kind of like longer play, you stay with the sounds and the playing with the sounds, and then kind of a word might emerge out of that or begin to suggest itself. But that attention to the sound itself, rather than forcing the word, it's just kind of, you become very aware of what is happening in your body, like how your face, how your whole, not just your face and your head, but how your whole body is involved in this language making process.
It's quite a yogic kind of exercise, isn't it?
It is. It's very present. It makes you feel very present in the kind of, you know, to sort of borrow a slightly maybe cringy term, but in the kind of like earth of yourself. If you know, with eco-poetic and environmental work, we're often looking outside of ourselves and thinking about the earth. But I think it's just as important, and a lot of practitioners are now talking similarly about it, that actually to root fundamentally in your human self is really, really important, because we're all animals as well. We may be human animals, but we are animals. So rooting into these parts of ourselves, maybe slightly uncomfortable part of ourselves, because language has been such a crucial thing over the years, or kind of in recent, you know, the recent centuries, in defining what it is to be human and setting ourselves apart from human language. So there feels to me something really important in in really sinking into your body and the points at which this defining feature begins to fall apart, and you start becoming aware of just the sound that we make and how those sounds relate to other parts of your experience, you know, whether it's an uncomfortable groan that might sometimes feel a bit frightening or a bit alarming, or something that leads you into kind of laughter-like things, or, you know, you kind of move through sound, through this whole range of human emotions and experiences. And what I find also is that in those moments, you actually become a lot closer to the animal world, because they're obviously, like, our language, as far as I'm concerned, is just a human version of all of the other languages that are happening out there in different ways, whether that's birds or animals or even insects, you know, like the communication that's happening.
I had an interview a few weeks ago that might be of interest to you with an artist named Ian Ingram, who builds robots that speak to animals in their languages, which are mostly kinetic. But it is really interesting, because in fact, his thinking is probably like the opposite end of the artistic spectrum, and yet very aligned with what you're doing, because he's saying essentially we need to, you know, he's exploring this idea of communication with the non-human through their own, in the ways that they would actually understand, which are not sonic, but are in fact the way a tail flickers, or, you know, the way that the upper body moves in certain circumstances. But since ours is sonic and is acoustic and is breath oriented, building those yogic kind of exercises is a really interesting sort of way to look at, to destroy words
yeah.
in a good way.
Yeah, exactly. I always feel like it's interesting. It feels to me important for the audience, because often the audience will feel kind of quite uncomfortable. They're like, oh, what's she doing? You know, because the loss of language is often associated with a kind of loss of faculties in some way. And that is frightening, and that can, and, you know, if especially when it's non, when it's not your choice. But that is part of the human experience. We sort of come into language, and then we can fall out of it at various different points, whether due to age or due to illness or whatever happens, or just sometimes due to kind of shock, you know, in our most emotionally heightened moments, when it's not speaking, it's sound that happens, and yet we continue to read each other's sound. And so that's the kind of thread for me with this, like, reading and writing, is that you're reading people's gestures. We are reading people's sounds, even as those sounds are embedded within words, with, you know, how people tone, the volume, the pitch, the proximity of their bodies to you. It's all giving you extra information. And so, again, drawing people's attention, kind of remembrance, because we all know this, we all do it intuitively, but it's so second nature. To me, when you begin to, like, degrade these things, that's when people are like, oh gosh, yeah, oh yes, I remember, this is something that I do, this is a skill that I have, and I didn't even realize it was a skill. The sort of focus becoming the lens, I suppose, that becoming focuses this work into, came out of a short radio series I did for Sound Art Radio during the pandemic, which was really curating different practitioners' ways of interacting with the non-human world. And I thought, great, you know, I can do it. It's an hour long, which has felt to me like quite long, but maybe it's not.
Can I interrupt you to tell me what you mean when you talk about the non-human world?
Yeah.
Or do you ever use the phrase more than human?
Yeah, I'm very fluid. I would say more than human. I'd say non-human. Sometimes, so non-human, I'm really talking about the animate world, but it can also be rocks that people are not necessarily thinking, or earth. You know, it's, I suppose, what people would broadly consider nature. But because of the issues around sort of how nature has been defined in opposition to human life, well, I suppose non-human and more than human, kind of at least there's a sort of sense of continuity there. So I suppose I'm using those terms to avoid the natural, non-natural idea that kind of what you make as a human may not be part of that. But so shall I return to the becoming bit? So I was creating this radio series with these different practitioners' ways of working with the non-human. So, for example, so it was becoming fungus. So I was working with fungus to begin with, plant, insect, bird, and animal. So those were the particular themes for the shows. And each series was had a little bit of science in there, a little bit of theory, and then quite a lot of treatments by artists, whether it was sound, performance, maybe fine art, book works, poetry, and how these different creative practitioners had responded to these sort of non-human life, living organisms. So with fungus, for example, we were really lucky to have Merlin Sheldrake as one of our as our sort of scientific contributor for that first one. And having done a little bit of work with fungus and it's kind of like collapsing and then reforming habits. I mean, obviously fungus is a huge, you know, as Merlin talks about, is this huge family of living organisms that is so partially, not even partially understood, like minutely understood by us, and is only just really fully emerging into human knowledge. But to take one, you know, one behavioral, say, strategy to look at, I was looking at how things were decaying and then regrowing, because that's a really important part of fungus or mold, is breaking things down in order for it to then become, like, you know, usable for other life forms, whether that's trees or insects or whatever it is. And then regrowing, because often, you know, the mycelium there is there, that the, all those sort of like networks are, the root networks continue to be there, and the fruiting body of the mushroom is what blooms and then comes back into the earth, and then it will bloom again and come back into the earth. And so I was looking at things like Stephen Emerson's work with fungus, which is very much which is, I mean, similar to Merlin Sheldrake, actually. Look, growing he was growing mushrooms out of the books, and thinking about how, you know, how we would think about what, how is the mushroom reading, for example, you know, like just questions like that, like, well, you know, what is, because it's reading it or using it or consuming it in a very different way to the way we would consume words. But so one of the strategies that I was thinking about is, okay, if you begin to, this is inspired actually by Angela Rawlings's practice. She has a beautiful piece on the Becoming Fungus episode, where the words, a little bit as I was demonstrating earlier, where the words begin to fall apart into sound and then recompose themselves into words again, and then fall apart and then recompose them. And so one of the strategies I've asked participants to do is you make a kind of short haiku, and then use a particular strategy to make that haiku fall apart into certain letters, and then using those letters as a base, recompose a new poem out of this base of letters, and then let it fall apart, and then you have new letters. So it's, I don't know how, I mean, it's probably not at all clear coming across as it is, like, audibly now, but that would be one example of the way. So you take sort of one strategy that, and that let's say the fungus or a bird or a plant might employ, and you try and think about ways in which you can embody that through, or how that can influence our compositional strategies in writing.
So kind of like the way in biomimicry in architecture, people might look at the way a bird builds its nest and think, how does that inspire me as an architect? You're literally just looking at the behaviors of these non-human animate objects. And that object is the wrong word. You know what I mean. Organisms, that's the word I was looking for. I got the O right. And thinking, you know, well, given the other ways that they live, what impact do they have if they made poetry in a way similar to us?
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of their own ways.
Yeah, and it's sort of a way for me, I think, having sort of basing it in the practices that I developed during my PhD, it was this occasion to really observe something that is not of yourself, and really try and learn something from this other life form, and think, how can I use that to change the way that I make things? And I'm not sure, you know, I sort of don't really, you know, it's not that I'm saying that this like kind of slightly mimetic technique is going to save the world in itself, you know, making strange compostable poems is not, but I think the attention that is necessary, I hope, will, you know, garner a sense of, I think empathy was a big thing for me when I first started the series, like really beginning to understand how these different life forms live, and hopefully get a sense of the humility that comes with that, of these, you know, huge communities of other than human life that are happening all the time, and actually really don't care, I wouldn't have thought, mostly about what we're doing as humans. And yet, you know, we also largely don't really care, unless it becomes a real problem, which it currently is, about these other life forms. So it's just trying to get a sense of us being one species amongst many other species that are happening and behaving in different ways. I think certainly just becoming part of an effort to become aware of what our cultural practices are and what it has meant for the rest of the world in a way that we're only just becoming really aware of. And I think a lot of people still are not fully aware. You know, even, you know, I'm somebody who would like to think I'm sort of trying to maintain an awareness, but the amount of data there is on, you know, how these other life forms live, what our impact is, that, I mean, it's absolutely huge. So it's also maybe trying to make it a little bit more manageable, you know, if we can all just try to cultivate a little bit more awareness of our environmental impact, then hopefully that will make a difference.
I mean, if you thought about language as a purely spoken way of communication, would that change this for you? Would that change your practice entirely? Because it does seem like, you know, the written word is such a strange, complicating, chaotic tool. I just wonder if you have any thoughts off the top of your head about that.
I definitely do, because that was one of the first, you know, there's a lot of literature that is very critical of writing practices, because of, you know, the claim or the sort of link to like knowledge formation in a way that takes us out of our kind of embodied relationship with the world, you know, that sort of takes us up into our heads, that is very linked with the kind of thinking mind, that's the sort of disembodied way of being in the world. And for me, and I think that's why I'm so why I feel like it's so important to engage with writing as material, because I don't feel that writing necessarily takes us out of our body, but it's in the forgetting of what the writing is made of and how, and in the forgetting of our own bodies and engagement with this reading material, that's what causes the kind of the forgetting of our environmental relationship. So in the performance that I did with Khaled Balgouti, a Palestinian dancer, it was called Reading Movement. And it was the kind of starting point for that was exactly trying to remember how certain postures and behaviors are kind of designed to encourage us to forget about our kind of physical being in the world. And if you start disrupting that, if, you know, so he, I would be reading a book and he would start moving me around, and even here where I'm just trying, you know, you can hear, yes, I'm trying to like read out loud the kind of, but the difficulty of trying to maintain reading and writing practices when the environment around you changes and shifts, and when you're suddenly actually like the physical object of the book is changing in relationship to you, whether it's close or far, or whether you're changing, it's like the particular environmental conditions of reading and writing are actually really precise and niche. You know, you have to be sitting in a particular way or standing in a particular way in order to effectively read and write. So I don't think necessarily like the objects and the practice in themselves, but I do think there is maybe work to be done about remembering how these material objects are created and what behaviors we engage with that maybe encourage us to forget about the body. Okay, so the Becoming course is really, the backbone of it is this radio show that I mentioned earlier. So the listening is like the set text. So the participants listen to this show that incorporates sort of sound art performance, a bit of scientists talking and poets in relation to these different themes. So there's the Becoming Fungus radio show that you start off with, which is an hour listening. And we start with a workshop based with, you know, grounding the participants in various different prompts that they can then take forward to make some kind of language work over the next week. And it's a very, very open idea of language making. You know, it may be asemic writing, so writing that is more mark making than a sort of, you know, a letter by letter formation. It may be more sound. It's something that is trying to communicate. Is the effort is in its communication and a kind of tangential relationship to language. Or you can be super super you know, just standard poetry. And then that the following week, so in the sort of week two of those fortnights, you upload your work to a Google Drive and we all share feedback and have a little bit of a chat about what's going on in different people's practices. And then the beginning of the next fortnight, the same pattern repeats with Becoming Plant, and then Becoming Insect, Becoming Bird, and Becoming Animal. And what worked really well in the first iteration of this course was actually, it was just a spontaneous invitation that I issued to participants at the end, because they'd created such interesting stuff. And I thought, gosh, I really would like to showcase this and share this kind of work with the world. And so we did an online exhibition that is still up on my Senior Apple Press website. And so there is that offer at the end of the course for people to showcase their work in an online exhibition. It's just really lovely to be able to give that work a home and give it a bit of airtime and promotion, because it is a weird, quirky, wild way of working with language. And obviously it's something that excites me. And so the more work that is out there in the world doing this, I feel like the more other people will be inspired and find a way into this kind of way of working.
Thank you for listening to Uncanny Landscapes. We'll be back soon with the next installment. My guest was Camilla Nelson, whose Becoming workshop starts the 13th of June online. Check it out at singingapplepress.com or follow the links in the Substack or Podbean descriptions. The music is by Chiron, a solo project from the frontman of Beautify Junkyards, from his new album Dreaming Eden on Bellbury Music and on Bandcamp. Beautify Junkyards is about to embark on a UK tour. Check it out, they're fab. The title theme is by the Bellbury Poly. The Uncanny Landscapes icon is by Stefan Musgrove. I'm Justin Hopper. Follow me on Instagram at OldWeirdAlbion. Subscribe to this podcast's cousin Substack, helpfully also called Uncanny Landscapes. Finally, all the links I've just mentioned are on the Uncanny Landscapes site, uncannylandscapes.podbean.com. More installments coming soon. If you've enjoyed this and other episodes, please subscribe to the Substack and like, rate, and share the podcast. Or just tell a like-minded friend. Or two. Until next time, consider, as I have been, the words of the writer Dan Fox on his fantastic Substack, Keep All Your Friends, at foxdan.substack.com. Consider when he writes, quote, many artworks are the wrong size. Often they're too big, a small idea turned into an enormous sculpture which gets in the way. There are murals that should be a single line of poetry, and enormous abstracts that should not be fabricated from steel for large city squares, but made from plasticine and eventually lost down the back of the couch. By the same token, there are plant pots that could be spectacular railway terminals, and seashells that should be sculpture gardens.